The following is an exclusive presentation of WI Garden Media, the voice of Garden Talk Radio.
Coming up on the program today, it's about how we can get our tomatoes to ripen before the first frost, as well as perennials that you may consider growing in your garden for years to come. Our guest is author, composter Rebecca Louie, and will answer your garden questions. The hour is full, and it starts right now.
You are listening to the most informationally packed hour of garden-focused radio in the country and on the internet with your host, husband and wife team Joey and Holly Baird. This is the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show.
Welcome to the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show. Thank you for being with us for the next hour. No matter how you're listening to our program, whether you're listening to on one of the 15 radio stations that is broadcasting our program here in 2021, through a radio app, through our parent website, the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com, Season 5, tap at the top of the page, podcast replay or in-studio video replay, we thank you for consuming the program. I am your host, Joy Baird. Beside me is my wife, co-host, best friend, and gardening partner,
Holly Baird.
This program is for you, about you, to help your garden grow better, to maintain your landscape, grow healthier trees, and make your grass look greener, as well as preserving what you grow. If you want to get a hold of us, you can do that in a couple of different methods. One being, you can send us an email to gardentalkradio@gmail.com. GardenTalkRadio@gmail.com. Or if you'd like to talk to us directly, you can give us a call at 1-800-927-SHOW. That's 1-800-927-7469. If we can't get to you during the program, leave a message. We'll call you back. Program, big program lined up. And we're going to talk about how you can ripen your tomatoes before your first frost, which for many of us is not, the countdown has begun, and it's not that far off. First thing we need to be aware of, Holly, before we get into how we can ripen our tomatoes prior to that first frost, is understanding how a tomato develops. A tomato, based in the reproductive method, in the flower, there are male and female parts, and just by wind or you touching it or a bug bumping into it, it will self-pollinate. Now, from the time that the flower is pollinated to the time you harvest the fruit, it's between 20 and 30 days based on this type of fruit. Cherries quicker, larger beefsteak takes a little bit longer. So now that we understand the basic premise of how the tomato and the time frame, we want to get them ripened before the frost, because later on in the season, they're not as pungent. They're not as wonderfully tasting in some instances because the plant's stressed out. It's seasons winding down. The nights get cooler. The plant doesn't produce as well. And we'd much rather have an okay red tomato than a bunch of green tomatoes.
Right. And that's just it, is that you want to get your tomatoes ready for harvest, essentially. And you might think, well, you know, I live in an area where I could harvest tomatoes up through December.
Good for you.
Good for you. But maybe that's not something you want to do.
Yeah.
Maybe you want to harvest them sooner. Maybe you are like, you know, I have this time where I want to can them. So there's a few things you can do to get them to essentially stop growing, and then they're going to produce.
Right.
Or they're going to stop producing, but you can have those tomatoes harvested.
Now, some people love fried green tomatoes. Now, I've never had fried green tomatoes. People are gasping at the radios right now, because apparently that's a thing.
I really would have thought that you've had fried green tomatoes.
You've never had them either, have you?
Yes, I have.
You've had fried green tomatoes. Mm-hmm. So you cut the green tomato, you roll an egg and a flour mixture
corn
with
spice.
Well, you do cornmeal.
Most people do cornmeal.
Some people do flour with a lot of different seasonings in that flour. And then you eat it like that, and apparently it's magnificent.
Right. Maybe we should make fried green tomatoes.
So that's one thing you can do with your unripened tomatoes.
We dehydrated some green tomatoes, or a green tomato.
A green tomato, just to see.
And it was good.
Worked out very well. So in order to get your tomatoes to ripen, and this one's a little more of a challenge than anything because of the environmental situation you may be in, but stop watering. If you've got an irrigation system, stop watering and then let nature, rainfall, you know, do what it does, but don't additionally add moisture to the soil. What you're going to do in a lot of these techniques is you're stressing the plant out to focus the fruit production that is currently being developed on the vine, and the plant's not thinking of trying to create more because it's developing the seeds and the fruit and for next year, next generation of seeds, and that's it. That's what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's what you're doing when you stop watering, is that it's stressing the plant out, essentially. Unless you, for some reason, live in a very wet climate, mm-hmm. that might not work. So another one would be to top your tomatoes, and basically you're just whacking off the top of the plant.
You're probably going to get some flowers. You know, you're gonna probably going to cut a couple limbs that had the flowers. But what you're accomplishing is the vertical growth to stop. This is the same thing with Brussels sprouts. You cut the top off so it focuses on the fruit rather than the growth of the plant. So you want to do all of these practices realistically about 45 days before your average first frost. Now, true enough, if the first frost is October 18th, there are times where it's frosted on the October 1st and times it hasn't frosted until November the 18th. So it's kind of a guideline in order to best get the most out of your plant that you can. If you've got all the fruit off and it still hasn't frosted, good for you. So kind of keep that in mind when you're thinking of how to do these techniques and the best for your area.
And for us, I feel like lately, or the past couple of years, you get this chance of frost like right in the beginning of October, and it typically doesn't happen, but you'll get that dip in temperature, and then all of a sudden
3 weeks of warmth.
Three more weeks of warmth. So you have to take that into consideration too. Now, I know people who are like, Labor Day weekend, that's it, I'm done gardening.
Yep.
And that's okay.
Memorial Day to Labor Day.
Yeah. So that's another option. So another thing you can do is you can cut the roots off or stop the roots from being able to pick up nutrients, essentially. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple ways to do that.
So you're going to take a shovel and come 6 inches off of your main stem, your growth out of the ground. It's coming out of the ground. And you're going to take the shovel 6 inches away from that and cut straight down 3/4 of the way around the plant. So you're essentially cutting off 3/4 of the roots, and then that will also limit what water uptake the plant will be receiving, as well as stressing the plant out, because you're damaging the roots. You're cutting off its life support, essentially, and then that will also accelerate the ripening of the fruit that is on the vine. And you can also take tomatoes and pick them while they're green or changing, wrap them in newspaper, put them in a box, and they will ripen. Maybe not as to the as well as they would outside, and they're going to be a little tougher skinned, but you're going to have red or ripened tomatoes based on your variety.
Right. And that definitely is an option as well, is to grab those tomatoes. I remember, I don't know, it was probably like 3 or 4 years ago now, we got threatened with a true bad frost. And we also had an early blight situation too, late blight, I mean. Mm-hmm. So with that combination, we ended up pulling all of the tomatoes off of our plants, and we did get that hard frost, and I think it stayed cold at that point for a while. So,
right.
So sometimes you have to, maybe you don't make the decision, but the weather does.
And the green tomatoes, to a certain degree, will ripen, maybe not as well as, I mean, obviously not as well as they would on the vine. Because the longer you leave them on the vine, the more sugars they're uptaking, the sweeter it is, that type of thing. But you can do that in order to get them to ripen. And we can dehydrate them, green or red. Now, the green obviously is not going to be as wonderfully tasting as the red, but they're not horrible.
No. And dehydrated, they have this sweetness to them, which is good. And you might like green tomatoes.
Like tomato candy.
Right. You might have like a green tomato recipe, like a salsa or something, or a chutney or some sort of sauce. You might, you know, you could mix in green tomatoes with something you're making with the red tomatoes, as long as, you know, you have a balance there. So it's not the worst thing to have green tomatoes.
For new gardeners, a chutney with, what is a chutney when we talk about tomatoes?
A chutney is basically like a sauce.
Okay.
You don't. Some people do make tomato chutney, but a lot of times it's done with like a fruit or something like a pear or an apple.
Okay.
Mango.
Then this would be a dish you would put on meat.
Right. It's like a. It's like a. like a dip or like a spread.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of meat, Walton's Incorporated has all the tools that you need except for the meat. And you can get everything at waltonsincorporated.com, waltonsinc.com.
Yeah, the Gardening with Joy and Holly radio show is brought to you today by our sponsor, Walton's Inc. We know you care about where your food comes from. You want to can, preserve, make all sorts of good stuff. But with the meat at waltonsinc.com, you can get all the equipment, seasoning, and supplies to make any meat product to your high standard. They also have this website called meatgistics.com, and there's over 15,000 users will help give your opinion, their opinion and guidance on meat processing issues. So you can go to waltonsinc.com or meatgistics.com for all the help, and they make everything from meat grinders, mixers, sausage stuffers, seasonings, and more.
Everything but the meat. Well, hang around. We're going to talk about, when we come back from the break, do not go anywhere, perennial plants that we would encourage to grow in your garden. You're listening to the Garden with Joy and Holly radio show.
Got a question for Joey and Holly? Send it via email anytime to gardentalkradio@gmail.com.
We here at the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show gardens understand that healthy soil is the key to a successful garden. We know that chemical fertilizer burns carbon out of the soil and kills the microbes needed for a healthy soil ecosystem. No worries. Chicken Soup for the Soil by Dr. Jim's will stimulate life into your soil, supplying all the nutrients most fertilizers neglect. Rather than force-feeding water-soluble chemical fertilizer, we suggest feeding the microbes a smorgasbord of 100% biodegradable nutrients that your plants can consume when they need them. The nutrients are readily available to maximize their genetic potential. Chicken Soup for the Soil will increase the quality of the fruit and vegetables you grow. Visit drjims.com. That's drjims.com. Rinse Kit, your hose on the go. No pumping, no batteries. Simply fill from your spigot or sink on your way out for up to 5 minutes of spray time anywhere. Spray it, wash it, Rinse Kit. Is your dog that's causing dead spots in your lawn? Dog urine can burn lawns and ruin the appearance of your lawn very quickly. Fortunately, our friends at Nature's Lawn has a solution for this problem with their Spotless Lawn product. Spotless Lawns three-way action helps neutralize dog urine, helps move it through the root zone, and then helps the grass recover. If there's still life left in the grass, Spotless Lawn will help resuscitate it. Visit naturelawn.com and look for Spotless Lawn. That's naturelawn.com and look for Spotless Lawn.
Protect your plants against damage with a 3-in-1 plant guard and special blend fertilizer. Visit ivyorganics.com.
The Gardening with Joy and Holly radio show is brought to you by the following: Blue Ribbon Organics, Naturally Green Products, Ironwood Tool Company, Easy Step Products, Rinse Kit, Soul Brew Kombucha, Wild Delight, Rincon Vitova, Chip Drop.
Find all sponsors at the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com and thank them for their support.
Welcome back to the Gardening with Joy and Holly radio show. Hydration problems? Tree Diaper has you covered.
Tree Diaper is a revolutionary watering system that slowly releases water around the base of any tree or plant as the soil dries. The Tree Diaper is filled with water from rain or when you water and slowly releases water over 3 weeks. Every time it rains, Tree Diaper recharges. No pipes, hoses, or electricity needed. You can water your plants and trees whether they're right by the house, down the road, or in the back 40. It also works under mulch. So whether you're a first-time gardener or advanced, Tree Diaper will improve the way you water your plants. It's made in the USA. You can find all the sizes they have available at treediaper.com. That's treediaper.com.
Take the guesswork out of watering your plants. treediaper.com. Well, another thing in which you can take the guesswork out of is growing plants that will produce year after year with minimal amount of effort on your part. We're talking about perennials that you can put in your garden that basically do the work for you. We got a list of them. Some we grow, some we will grow, and some we encourage you to grow. And we'll start with asparagus. Asparagus can be grown pretty much anywhere, can last 20 to 50 years, and produce every year without fail after you get it established.
Right. Now, depending on what zone you're in, you might have more options, but these are pretty much universal for all zones where you can have these perennial edibles. So yeah, so asparagus is a perennial vegetable, and we just planted some last spring.
If we knew what we know now 10 years ago, we would have put it in the ground 10 years ago.
Right.
But it, you know, it's one of those things.
And asparagus is kind of funny when it grows, because it looks like it shouldn't be growing, but it is growing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a joke plant almost. So it just grows straight out of the ground. And you would think it probably would grow on like a bush or something, but it just grows out of the ground.
Little sticks coming out of the ground. Now you've got green, you can do white, and there's purple varieties of asparagus. Homegrown asparagus compared to store-bought asparagus, no comparison. Even if you just get it from the farmer's market, because it was typically harvested in the last 8 hours, incredible flavor there is. Now, another one that many people may not be familiar with is sunchokes or Jerusalem artichokes, which is not the globe that people may associate with that terminology.
Right. And I know like most people know them as sunchokes or sunroot, something like that. And they actually are related to the sunflower family and the dahlia family. But what it is it's a plant that grows a very tall flower on top. That's not the part you eat. The part you eat is underground, and it's like a tuber. And it tastes like a sweeter, less starchy potato. And
with a little touch of turnip rutabaga mixed in.
Yeah, like a little root crappy,
earthy, little parsnip mixed in, yeah. Kind of a little bit of combination. That's kind of what they taste like.
Yeah, and they're pretty good. I like them, and they are perennial. They can be a teeny bit invasive, not as invasive as other plants like mint or something, but they can grow or spread a little bit, so that's something to keep in mind.
And there's a lot of things in which you can do with them. You can eat them raw. You can roast them. You can pickle them. You can can them in certain applications. And they will come back for many, many years, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. There's a burgundy variety and a white variety. And they can and they're found in a lot of places across the country. And if you don't know what you're looking for, you will miss it every time in the natural setting. Because it looks just like a weed.
Right. It does. And, like I said, it produces really pretty flowers. So that's a fun part, too. So the next one is rhubarb.
Which is a staple in a lot of European allotments. You see a lot of rhubarb in those in videos and imagery the size of small cars. And they can last 7 to 15 years. You got to divide them. We are able to grow it in a container, can be done, and it is done successfully. We started ours from seed. Many people will get a two-year root or crown and plant it that way, and it will produce. The plant stalks are edible. There is green, a whitish, and a red variety. The leaves are toxic, so that's
right.
Why
yeah,
you don't see the leaves in the store. You just see the stalks.
You just eat the stalks, so you don't eat the leaves.
It's an acquired taste. It's very bitter if you're not familiar or you don't like bitter things. I associate rhubarb as a bitterness flavor. But
it's kind of sour, bitter.
Now, when you mix it in with like a strawberry rhubarb pie, you really don't notice it as much. But you got to know what you're getting into before you invest the time and the space in to grow any of these things.
Right. So if you're not sure about rhubarb, I mean, I feel like everybody in the Midwest knows about rhubarb, but maybe where you live, you're like, I've never had that. That's not a thing here. You can definitely a lot of times go to like an organic food store, especially in the spring, like the later spring, and they usually will have rhubarb for sale.
Yeah, and most stores have that. It's not going to be as good as what you would grow, but you at least get the flavor. Flavor compounds and figure out if you like it or not. Strawberries. We grew strawberries in our garden for about 6 years. Typical lifespan of a strawberry, we had June bearing, is between 5 and 7 years. And I think, if I remember right, and I would have to go back and look at videos, I think we had like 75 or 115 square feet or something like that. And they had a lot of runners, and we were getting
upwards of 15 pounds a year of strawberries out of our own garden.
I would say it was between 70 and 100 yeah. square feet. But yeah, it was. They were fun to grow, and they were very prolific. They kind of took over yes. that patch because they have the runners. But, you know, we had a lot of strawberries. At one point, I remember that one summer, we harvested a ton of
we
them.
We never went to a pick-your-own farm.
It was just so many.
Right. And,
yeah, so it's like, when it comes to strawberries, you want to have more, I would say, especially mm-hmm. we had the June-bearing kind as opposed to the ever-bearing. So that was, we would get that bulk of the June harvest.
In ground, my pet peeve is people who try to grow strawberries in a container. You're babying that thing for 50 weeks a year in order to get 2 weeks and about 12 strawberries off of it. So if you're going to do that, just bypass that and buy organic or go to your pick-your-own farm. Much better investment utilizing that container for something else rather than a plant that produces just 2 weeks a year or 3 weeks a year for a dozen or so berries. Another one is berry plants. So that gives you the option of raspberries, golden raspberries, black raspberries,
blueberries.
Blueberries, you need acidic soil. You plant them in a normal garden bed, they will die.
You know, I want to talk about this because there's this video that's going around and has been on the social media, and it shows to take a fresh blueberry and squish it, and then you plant it in a party cup, and all of a sudden you should have a blueberry plant, and that might happen, but once you get to the point, then it's like, oh, just plant it outside, and that's not the case. You need to make sure, I mean, yes, you could probably start a blueberry.
Right.
But once you don't just all of a sudden go out to your back door, walk out the back door, go to the left and plant this plant. It's not going to keep growing. So you want to keep in mind that blueberries do want that acidic soil.
Right. False. A lot of stuff on the internet is for clicks and ad buys, and that's it. Two more very quickly. Chives come back year after year. You can divide them, as well as horseradish comes back many, many years, and you can divide that, as well as mint, but you want to put mint in a container or a controlled environment. Otherwise, mint will shoot runners like Creeping Charlie, and you will have a garden of mint that will choke out everything else. So just some things in which you could grow in your garden next year, and there's fruit trees and other bushes in which produces edible quantities of food. But just give you an idea, some things you might want to consider to locate and take up some real estate that does a lot of work for you is perennial plants. Well, another thing, Holly, nights are getting colder, kids are getting back in school, and we've all, as well as us, have forgotten about our lawn, and you don't want to do that.
Yeah, just because it's fall, we don't want to forget about our yards and those Japanese beetles, you know. Just a few weeks ago, they were all over the place, but they may be gone. But they're not far. Not only did they feast on your roses and berries, this summer they laid eggs in your turf so they can start again next year. You want to take a stand with Phylum's GrubGon. GrubGon is a non-chemical BT granular that specifically targets scarab pests and their larvae. So you simply add the granular with a spreader, irrigate into the soil, and let the naturally occurring bacteria do its job.
Not only is GrubGon easy to use, but the best part about it, it's non-chemical choice. Effectively, it's the only non-chemical choice to effectively control grubs. And the best part about it, it does not have any toxicity that affects pollinators, beneficial insects such as ladybugs, butterflies, and bees. That's GrubGon. Has zero label restrictions, uses around flowers, so you don't have to worry about those insects picking it up and taking back to their homes and toxifying their whole families. GrubGon from PhylumBioProducts.com, the natural choice. That's PhylumBioProducts.com, PhylumBioProducts.com, BioProducts.com. When we come back, Rebecca Louie will be with us, author. You're listening to The Garden with Joey and Holly radio show.
Have a garden question? Give Joey and Holly a call now or anytime 24/7. Just dial 1-800-927-SHOW. If you can't get through, leave a message and they will call you back. Call now 1-800-927-SHOW.
Pomona's Universal Pectin is a high-quality pectin that gels reliably with low amounts of any sweetener. If you're trying to reduce the amount of sugar in your diet, you'll love Pomona's Universal Pectin. Now you can make healthy homemade jams and jellies, sweetened to your taste. You can use sugar or honey to sweeten. Bomono's Universal Pectin keeps indefinitely when stored in an airtight container. Easy to use, versatile, and comes with directions and recipes in every box. Find out more and where to buy at PomonaPectin.com. Also available at natural food stores and online. Straight from the farm, fields, and briar patch, Piper and Leaf Artisan Tea is a tea like you've never imagined it. Get our award-winning tea delivered right to your front door and become part of the Piper and Leaf family. Free shipping over $75 at PiperandLeaf.com. Did you know that all flour is not created equal? Janie's Mill carefully stone grinds all their certified organic wheat, rye, corn, buckwheat, and heirloom and ancient grains so that you get every bit of taste and nutrition nature intended. Some flours really are better than others, and you deserve the best. Get it at janiesmill.com.
Brought to you by Blue Ribbon Organics, providing locally made organic compost and soil blends for gardens, farms, landscaping, and more. Visit BlueRibbonOrganics.com or call 262-497-8539 to find their products nearest you. Tired of dealing with bugs but don't want to use harmful chemicals to repel them? Naturally Green No More Bugs is all natural and plant-based. No more chemical bug repellent. Use it around your home and on you, indoors and out, DEET free, and will not stain, repels mosquitoes, ticks, fleas, roaches, ants, flies, and more. No More Bugs is the answer to what is bugging you. Stop using harmful chemicals and use what is safe for you, your family, pets, and the environment. For more information, visit natgreenproducts.com. Natgreenproducts.com.
Have essential oils always confused you like they did me? Take out some of the guesswork with Simply Earth. The Simply Earth Essential Oil Recipe Box will help you gain confidence and clarity in using essential oils to help make your home toxin-free. Here's how it works. You receive the recipe box with 4 pure essential oils, 6 recipe cards, and extras. Then you learn how to use your essential oils while making the recipes created by certified aromatherapists. Clear and concise step-by-step directions. Save money and detoxify your life. I got to make fun products that will detoxify my home while also learning safe ways to use my essential oils. The best part is these oils don't break my budget. Simply Earth's essential oils are 100% pure and come from the best farms from all over the world. Using essential oils to support your wellness doesn't have to be overwhelming. My home is one step closer to being toxin-free because I made the wax melts and more with the Simply Earth Essential Oil Recipe Box. Visit simplyearth.com to find your recipe box and more.
The Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show is brought to you by the following: Simply Earth, Seed Savers Exchange, Quick Snap Sprinklers, Water Hoop, Timber Pro Coatings, Bloomin' Easy Plants, Pomona Universal Pectin, Ivy Organics, Tiger Torch, Happy Leaf LED, Seedlink. Find all sponsors at the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com and thank them for their support. Welcome back to the Gardening with Joy and Holly radio show. Moments away, Rebecca Louie. But first...
So during the dry summer months, you'll notice more aggressive yellow jackets flying around. Yellow jackets are looking for your barbecue meat, sweet drinks, as well as water sources. You want to keep them at bay with rescue yellow jacket traps. Rescue yellow jacket traps are an eco-friendly do-it-yourself option to keep these stinging pets away from you. The traps use a powerful lure for yellow jackets, and they will not attract beneficial honeybees. All rescue products are made in the USA. You can go to rescue.com where you can find where to buy rescue products and other things. That's rescue.com.
Holly, let's go to the hotline and bring in our guest for this week.
Rebecca Louie is the Compostess. She's a New York master composter, beekeeper, avid gardener, and also the author of Compost City Practical Composting Know-How for Small Space Living. Welcome to the program, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we thank you for taking time out of your day, not only to educate Holly and myself, but all of our listeners across the country. We thank you for that.
I'm excited to chat compost, that's for sure.
So let's start with this. What is a master composter, and how did you go about getting that certification? Because we know about master canners and master gardeners, but this is a new term for probably many of us.
Yeah, I think those are actually perfect examples. Basically, you know, like many townships and municipalities that have programs like Master Gardening, there are many across the country that do master composting as well. And essentially, a master composter is someone who really digs deep, if you will, into what happens in the soil ecosystem and how you can basically transform any organic wastes into compost to help nurture the land. So depending on where you live, the program can range anywhere from a few weeks to a few months. Sometimes there might be, you know, related costs or community service components to this. But essentially, it's a way for people who are truly invested in recycling organic wastes, feeding the land, nurturing the soil, to kind of really get down and dirty into the deep, nerdy, wonderful aspects of composting.
Now, we're talking about the traditional heat the compost pile up, stir it, and break it down, or are we actually, or are we talking about vermicomposting tied in with this?
Yeah, so ideally, the best master composter certification programs cover everything. Okay. So, you know, there's trenching underground, there's setting up a range of outdoor bins that can either be enclosed or exposed to air or lined with hardware cloth to keep out pests. Then there's some of these methodologies that are maybe considered indoor activities like vermicomposting or bokashi fermentation. And so basically it's a really full, exciting curriculum of all the different ways and all of the different scales that you can compost at. So if an individual is interested in doing one banana peel a day or a week, great. You've started, you're doing the work, amazing. If you're looking to like feed the soil of a full community garden or even something larger, you know, school programs, et cetera, there are solutions and strategies to get there as well.
Okay, that's really great information. Now, you weren't always, you know, all about being so in touch with nature or green living. What changed that, and how did you become more into gardening, composting, the whole green living lifestyle?
That's a great question. And just to preface it, if I can go through this transformation, I'm pretty sure anyone on this planet can as well. But yeah, I grew up in New York City, and there, you know, even though I did have a backyard where I grew up, it was mostly like the patio. It was like the concrete place to go and have a barbecue. Like I didn't really have a connection to nature or the trees around me. And so it really took well into my 20s and early 30s after a career as like an entertainment and lifestyle reporter, kind of the opposite of sustainability, kind of, you know, over the top red carpet versus green living, to kind of make the leap. And really the thing that transformed my perspective on the world was starting to cook more. And it's something that we all do. Hopefully everyone, you know, gets in the kitchen every now and then, loves eating. And, you know, as I started cooking more at home, I started to think like, oh man, yes, I'm creating a great meal, but what about all this other stuff that's a result of what I've cooked? And it was a lot. You know, like any kind of dish, the fruit peels, the vegetable ends. And so I was like, what can I do with this? How can I make it useful? So, you know, like most people, I turned to the internet and I read all these things and I was like, okay, I could do this. And I actually started with worms, speaking of worms, and I failed miserably because I think I got very overzealous. And I don't know, we can talk about all sorts of ways to do worms a little bit better. But, you know, the lesson for me was like, okay, I didn't do this right. I'm still interested in doing it. So how can I? And that's actually what led me to the Master of Composting certification, which then was way more fun than I could have imagined it would have been. And it's kind of changed my life, getting me to where I am today.
Well, let's talk about worm composting. Holly and I have talked about that on the program before, vermicomposting on the show. Can you offer us some tips on why people should consider doing it, what you did wrong and what you're doing right? And also the question that comes up, does it smell when you vermicompost indoors?
Yeah, so maybe I'll start with that last question first, which is across any composting system, if you are doing it right, which just takes a little bit of like information on the front end of things, there are ways to prevent odor. Perfectly easy to do. And so does vermicomposting smell? Nope, not bad, at least. If you're doing it right, you open up that worm bin and it's like, you know, walking in the Amazon jungle, like this beautiful, rich soil, beautiful scent that like wafts all over you, if you are doing it right. And so the doing it right is the challenge, okay? So the interesting thing about worms and why people might be interested in doing it is that it's convenient. You can do it indoors. So it's not like you're, you know, outside with a pitchfork and like sweaty in the sun. It can be kind of discreet meaning if it is indoors in your apartment or in your house, you know, a lot of people do a DIY version of a worm bin that's just in something like a, you know, a storage tote drilled with holes. And that could go in a closet, can go under the bed, which I know a lot of people love the idea of worms under the bed. But it's neat and discreet. Plus, I will say that if you are either a curious person or your roommates are curious or you have kids, they are kind of like pets. You know, unlike a lot of composting, which is very microbial and a little bit abstract, you know, in terms of who's doing the work, like a vermicompost bin will have something like 1,000 worms in it to start. And you see them and you can be kind of affectionate towards them, and that can be really fun in terms of like learning and engaging and kind of committing to doing it well. However, I will say in my case, and I would guess like in the case of many people, that can sometimes be a newbie's downfall. Because you know how when you have something new and cute and exciting and you just kind of want to feed it, and you get very excited about feeding. You know, the worst thing you can do to a worm bin is overfeed it, because it is a little universe. And, you know, like any living creatures, they are only going to eat what they're going to eat. And if they're not catching up to the amount that you're giving them, what's left over will just start to do its thing and decompose. And that's where you start to run into odor issues. That's where you can create a bin that's kind of acidic and actually very detrimental to the worms, and actually invite other guests, they are guests, but pests, depending on your perspective. And so my biggest tip that I have for any new wormer is portion control. And I tend to, with my worms, get a small container, maybe like a pint size, like, you know, takeout soup thing, or like a yogurt container. Fill it up with food scraps and think of that as like a portion. And a secondary tip is you can freeze those scraps first and then thaw them out. And that does two things. One, it kills any pest eggs on the surface. So if, you know, maybe the bananas were, you know, at a display outside the grocery and maybe a fly landed on it and then laid eggs or something, so they'll be frozen. Plus, in the thawing process, a lot of liquid will leach out. And so you can drain that liquid before you put it in the worm bin because, you know, again, we want them to be comfortable. And so with that portion, you feed it and you resist all temptations to give them any more food until you see that portion go away, or almost go away. And then you know they're ready for the next one. And that's kind of the biggest success tip. I mean, I absolutely overfed my first worm bin because I had read statistics about how quickly they consume things online. But that's like always in the ideal. And I think we all know that we rarely live up to our potential in terms of how ideal we're living our lifestyles. So that also applies to worms as well. So do your best to just make sure they have what they need and nothing more.
Gotcha. So we are talking with Rebecca Louie. She's a master composter, author, beekeeper, and more. So let's talk about beekeeping. What are some things people should keep in mind or learn about before they dive into that?
Yes. So I started beekeeping again with these like sort of grand ambitions and these like peaceful ideas of like that will be so serene. How interesting. Interesting, yes, but maybe not as serene as I thought. And there are a couple of things that people should know going into the art of honey beekeeping. One, you need a pretty hefty amount of knowledge on the front end going into it, right? Like you need to realize, A, that it's a seasonal endeavor. So depending on where you live, there's a very specific time of year that you need to start, because that will give the bees and the population time to grow over the seasons, collect enough honey that they need, or nectar to turn into honey that they need for the winter, etc. But, you know, there's also a financial investment in it as well, because there is a lot of gear involved in beekeeping. So those are two things that I think people should be aware of going into it. And then the fact that there is ongoing maintenance. It's not like you just set up a honeybee hive and you're like, great, we did it. Let's go, girls. And I say girls because the hive is like 90% female. But first of all, there are the regular checks that happen every couple of weeks, full inspections of the entire hive just to make sure everything is going on as it should be in there. Then there are sort of seasonal things that you do, you know, checking for varroa mites, you know, adding boxes as the population is growing. So this ongoing work is something that sometimes falls by the wayside for a new beekeeper, because they don't necessarily realize the commitment that's involved and really kind of going the long haul with your bees. And I guess lastly, there are things like environmental considerations. Depending on where you live, if, for example, they're bare in the region, you might need to create some sort of electric fence or other types of protections like ratchet straps, et cetera, for your hives. Certain municipalities require that you register your hives. And then there's like the good neighbor policy, where, you know, depending on how population dense your area is, there may be considerations around whether or not it's appropriate to have hives in certain areas, or there may be like actual logistic things you need to get like approved and some such, depending on where you are. So that's the big picture. But I will say there is an option that I don't think people realize, which is to nurture native bees. There are 4,000 native bee species in North America. And if you want to kind of cut some of the, you know, infrastructure and kind of commitment and maintenance out of the way, you know, there are these native bee homes or hotels that you can set up in your yard and nurture the populations for these native bees that actually live very solitary lifestyles. So it's like one per hole and then it's eggs versus like a colony of 50,000 at the height of summer. Now, so that's something I like to share.
With beekeeping, would you suggest it's kind of like canning or going for mushrooms? You follow somebody and learn and shadow somebody for a while until you understand the procedure of what you need to do and how to do it before you go out and venture on your own and invest in beekeeping on yourself?
Yeah, I love that as a suggestion. That's such a good one, because not only do you get the hands-on education with someone who's experienced, but frankly, you start to understand your own relationship to bees. Because when you open up that box, and let's say it's the height of honey season and they're trying to like protect their honey and they're flying into your face, you know, depending on who you are, you may not actually be comfortable or able to relax in the way you need to in that kind of situation to get through a hive. So the more exposure you have on the front end, like, you know, with a mentor or as an apprentice somewhere, you're absolutely right. That's a great suggestion. If people have that opportunity, I say go for it and really like dip your toes in the real experience.
Now, as a master composter, do you have a preference of cold composting or hot composting or vermicomposting? What is your go-to method?
Yeah, well, I would say that I like it easy.
Right.
You know, it's I have like a bazillion setups just because I'm a bit nerdy about it, but I also do not need to spend too much time on any of them because life is hectic enough. So personally, you know, if hot composting happens kind of organically because, let's say, I've mowed the whole lawn and I've made a giant pile of grass clippings and it's hot and they're wet and like nature does its thing and magically makes it hot, great. But am I going to kind of pursue the active work of hot composting, which actually there's a bit of a science to, like there's certain ratios of like dry items and wet items that you put in, you turn it on a certain schedule. Like that's great if you are working at a certain scale or you have ambition to like achieve a certain amount of compost. But for me, like if I could just sit back and kind of move items around and leave them there for nature to do the rest of the work, that is A-okay with me.
Right. Before we ask about your book, I know people are wanting me to ask this question. Who are curious about vermicomposting, do you have to worry about overpopulation in a worm bin?
That's a good question. I have two answers to that.
Okay.
The quickest answer is the population will only grow to the amount of space that you provide it, because there is a little bit of, you know, reality of like the space itself does not hold beyond like the population mm-hmm. itself. However, that will be like in a standard bin. That's more of like a single chamber.
Okay.
However, there are things like stacked flow through worm bins where basically the idea is you keep adding layers, sort of like floors on an apartment building. And you add those layers as they sort of eat everything in layer one, then you add another floor, then they start migrating up to, you know, the second floor, and then third floor, fourth floor, et cetera. And actually, those types of systems are much more forgiving, or I should say they invite population growth because the herd is constantly moving. Mm. So overpopulation is a good thing if it happens, or if you find that it's getting densely populated, because then, you know what, split them, make right. another bin, give them to a friend. But I don't think people have to worry about, like, the worms, you know, emerging and taking over their house because there's too many of them.
Thank you. So you have your book, which is the Compost City Practical Composting Know-How for Small Space Living. What is something you can tell us about your book or give us an overall about it? And then reasons, maybe unique reason or a good tip in there that encourages our listeners to check it out.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for mentioning it. And I will say that I think my approach to composting, I hope, is trying to hit everybody where they're at. And that's kind of my main takeaway from the book, which has a ton of science, a ton of methodology, hopefully a lot of funny-ish jokes and like some cute illustrations. You know, it's a pretty user-friendly book. But really the message is that anyone can find an entry point into composting that fits their schedule, that fits their lifestyle, and that fits, you know, their kind of interest level, frankly. And so, you know, while it's called Compost City, it really is for any kind of person who I like to call like the eco-curious that kind of wants to dip their toe in and get started and then maybe kind of grow with the practice if they find that it's, you know, working for them in their lives. So in terms of a tip, you know, a lot of people have, I get it, like fear or worry about, you know, compost either being stinky or attracting pests. And, you know, what I talk a lot about in the book are really, really simple, easy solutions that prevent that from happening. And it's like, if you know those things going into whatever system you choose, it's really practical maintenance and it will set you up for success later. So you don't have the kind of like heartbreaking experience where things go wrong or, you know, suddenly you're in a funk that you did not really think you wanted in your personal spaces. So yeah, basically it's for anyone. Anyone can do it. And there are plenty of ways to start and be successful quite easily.
Well, Rebecca, we greatly appreciate the time you've offered Holly and myself and our listeners. How can people find more about you and how can they get their hands on your book?
Yeah, well, I'm on social media. I particularly enjoy being on Instagram. So you can follow me at The Compostess on Instagram. The book is available wherever fine reading is available, but, you know, your local bookstores or on websites, et cetera. So it's hopefully easy to find and, of course, is in circulating in a lot of library systems as well. So, you know, if you're not looking to purchase the book, that is something that you could either request your library to order if it's not there, you know, or find like other pathways for sharing or like communal sharing, like at your local, you know, botanical gardens or gardening groups, et cetera, because sometimes those organizations will have libraries as well.
Well, Rebecca, we greatly appreciate the time you offered us and we've learned some things in this little short time that we've had. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. This was great fun. Happy composting.
Absolutely. And when we come back, it's all going to be about your garden questions, our garden answers. You're listening to the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show.
Have a garden question? Give Joey and Holly a call now or anytime 24/7. Just dial 1-800-927-SHOW. If you can't get through, leave a message and they will call you back. Call now 1-800-927-SHOW.
The number one key to healthy, productive plants are the roots. Starting from seed to full-grown plants, RootMaker.com has the answer. From seed starting trays with an innovative design that air prunes the roots, creating a fabulous root system, never again will you have root-bound plants to multiple gallon grow bag sizes to raised beds. RootMaker.com has your grow needs covered. Visit RootMaker.com. Use coupon code RADIO21 and get 15% off your entire order. You move your lawn sprinklers all over the yard, but you always end up putting them in the same spots. Why not just bury them there? Out of sight, always ready to use, pre-adjusted to water the precise areas you want. Quick Snap Sprinklers makes it easy. In-ground sprinklers without the hassle or expense of laying pipe. Put the sprinklers anywhere in your lawn or garden. Snap on a hose to supply the water. Water on, it pops up. Water off, it drops below ground. You can mow right over it. You can have a buried sprinkler system up and running in just minutes. Each Quick Snap saves thousands of dollars. They install in minutes and operate for years. Visit quicksnapsprinkler.com.
Hello, I'm Joey Baird from the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show. If you're looking for merchandise for the program, you can go to thatismyshirt.com and get shirts with our logos on it. If you'd want to go a different route, they have a lot of comical, logical, and witty sayings on shirts that you can wear that makes a statement. From valedictorian from Common Sense University to I Heart Compost to Don't Be Just Average Today and a number of other great sayings. It all can be found at thatismyshirt.com. thatismyshirt.com. Sizes from small to five extra large and multiple colors per shirt to choose from. thatismyshirt.com.
Dig planting holes from a comfortable standing position. Step, twist, pull, and plant. Visit proplugger.com.
The Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show is brought to you by the following: ProPlugger, DripWorks, Walton's Incorporated, Tree Diaper, Janie's Mill, Phylum Bioproducts, Chapin Manufacturing Incorporated, Nature's Lawn and Garden Incorporated, Deer Defeat, Dr. Jim's, Rootmaker. Find all sponsors at thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com and thank them for their support. Welcome back to the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show. Thank you for being with us this hour. Time for questions and answers. You got a question, you can submit it. GardenTalkRadio@gmail.com. GardenTalkRadio@gmail.com. Or you can give us a call at 1-800-927-SHOW. That's 1-800-927-SHOW. Had questions come in this week. We'll start with this one. My potatoes are knobby and gnarly in one area of my lawn, my yard, that is near the grass. This has been treated by my lawn service, but they are okay further away from the lawn. What is causing this problem with my potatoes?
So it's because of the lawn service. Whatever is being sprayed on the lawn is going into the groundwater, it's getting to the potatoes, and it's causing them to grow inefficiently, knobby, gnarly, etc. The potatoes that are further away from the lawn and having the lawn service spray are fine because they're not having that pesticide, herbicide, or whatever seep into their groundwater as close. So that's why they are fine. So if you do have your lawn sprayed, maybe you perhaps want to grow like not a root crop near that, move it further away or something, put some flowers there, whatever.
Or look for an organic means.
Organic means to control your lawn problems.
A lot of my vegetables aren't producing as well anymore. Peppers, tomatoes, garlic. I haven't done much differently. Should I add something to the soil or get a soil test, or what is your advice?
I would definitely recommend a soil test, especially if it's been years and years that maybe you're like, you notice a decline in the small, maybe having smaller vegetables.
Never had a test.
Less of a harvest, etc. Especially if you're thinking about adding something, because if you add too much of one thing or you throw off the balance, that can mean even another year of bad vegetables. So if you get the soil test done, then you can get an idea of what to add.
University Extension Office does a test for a small fee, and you can find out a lot of information. So check that out online. Do a search for soil test in your area. Okay, next question. I planted Brussels sprouts at the same time as my butternut squash, and my squash is doing well, but I have yet to see sprouts on my Brussels sprouts. Any reason why? Are the sprouts not going to form? Well, this is a problem that many newer gardeners, I guess, the best terminology to use, find themselves in. That Brussels sprouts take a very long time to mature. Sometimes the package says 90 to 120 days. It does take a long time. Now, the key to get very good and very large sprouts on your Brussels sprouts is to top the plant. Now, if you are, you know, you're about 45, 50, 60 days out, 2 months out of the end of the season, and you begin to see the knobs or the sprouts begin to develop at the joint of the plant between the stalk, the limb, and the stem, go ahead and top your Brussels sprouts. That means go in there with a scissors, a secular, some type of cutting device, and go down 6 inches from the top and hack it off. going to look dramatic. It's going to look scary, but it's okay to do that. What is occurring when you do that, when you top that plant off? Just like we talked about with tomatoes, you're cutting the, you're telling the plant stop growing vertical and start putting on the fruit that you got, or start producing what you're supposed to do. You're going to see the sprouts on the Brussels sprout begin to get larger. Continue to hydrate, continue to do all of those things that you normally would do, but just top that plant off. The sprouts, that way, your sprouts will be as large as possible. Same thing as we've talked about on the program with hardneck garlic. You cut the scape off in order to put more energy into the bulb. You're cutting the top off the Brussels sprout in order to put more energy into the sprout development and size rather than the vertical growth of the plant. We've had plants that have been 3 and 4 foot, almost 5 foot tall in some instances. We topped them early, and the sprouts have been as large as golf balls. So great way to get larger sprouts, top the plant off. Next question, I have some Utah tall celery that I have grown, and this year I find it to be extremely tough. Do you have any suggestions on why that might be? One thing that comes to my mind immediately is you haven't watered it adequately. If you do not water plants such as lettuce, spinach, celery, whatever the case is, it's going to get extremely tough because it is in a survival mode, not a production mode. Its job is to do what it needs to do in order to put sprouts on or put seeds on to carry on the traits for the next generation. So by not watering it on a regular basis, this can cause the plant to be very stressed. So there's not really much you can do about it now once you've harvested it, but what you can do is potentially cook it down, that type of thing, and try to make it, you know, edible, but not watering is the problem there. Next question. Is there any reason why I could not place a raised bed over my septic system tank? Well, in a lot of places in rural areas, you have a septic system. You don't have a sewer system in which the byproducts of the house can get released into the sewer, and away it goes to the municipal plant. In the rural areas, there is a system or a tank underground where it breaks down, and then once the products of the house has gone into the septic system, and then a breakdown process has occurred, once the liquid or the tank gets to a certain level, there are exit ports in which it will, there's a pipe, and it will run out to a certain low-lying area and will get soaked into the ground. So, and all septic tanks have a lid in which one can get inside of it to fix problems or whatever the case is, pump it out if there's an issue. So the question is, again, is there any reason why you couldn't put a raised bed over top of the septic system tank? Here is two things you want to keep in mind. One, you could potentially have too much weight in that raised bed, and the weight can collapse the ceiling of the tank, assuming it's concrete or like a vault underground. Secondly, if you have a raised bed on top of your septic system tank, you most likely may not know where the hole is or the lid is for entrance and exit for people who may need to get in there and fix it, or if there's a problem or whatever the case is. So you may be covering that up as well. The best answer I can give you is no, don't put it over top of the septic system tank. Try to find elsewhere to put it. And be also aware in rural areas, if you are in that situation, know where the area is where the tank flows out of and into the low-lying area. You should be able to smell it or see it's a very boggy, wet area, so keep away from that so there's no contamination to the vegetables in which you're growing. Well, with that being said, we are out of time, and we thank you for yours. Miss any portion of the program today or want to revisit it, you can do that by going to our parent website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com, clicking on the Season 5 tab at the top of the page. Or you can send us an email to gardentalkradio@gmail.com. We'll send you a link to this show. Do not miss next week's show. We're going to be talking about growing indoors over winter as well as fall fruit. And our guest will be author David DeBoer, and we'll answer your garden questions. So until next week, for
Holly Baird,
I'm Joy Baird, and we will see you in the garden.